Good morning, good morning. We are dancing in with Soul Mikasa, Mano Dibango. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, right here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, with your Friday Speak Up Show. Have we got a treat in store for you. Good morning, good morning. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here at the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby Mountain, and streaming worldwide at cjsf.ca. Our treat for you today is the artistic director, Gordon Girard, the soloist, Marion Newman, and director, Ann Hodges, of the contemporary opera, Song from the Uproar, are our guests today. So I would let each of you introduce yourself and tell us, why are you so passionate about this play?
Well, my name is Gordon. I'm the artistic director of City Opera Vancouver. It's a job that I started just a few months ago in September. And this piece, Song from the Uproar, which is an opera, one-act opera, is sort of our first real outing as a company since I took over. So I'm very excited to lead the company in somewhat of a new direction in terms of programming. I'm excited about the team we've assembled and to tell this story about a pretty remarkable character. So I'm excited for people to learn about her and to hear this amazing music.
Yes, and it's great that the play is going to start right at the beginning of Women's Month, so it'll increase people's consciousness about her.
Oh, that's great. Absolutely, for sure.
Yeah, and I'm Marion Newman. I'm a mezzo-soprano, and I'm singing the role of Isabel Eberhardt, who is the person that this is about. And Isabel was this cool explorer. She only lived to 27, but lived a life that, you know, she crammed so much in. She could have been 88, honestly. So I'm really excited to play this role of somebody who was a strong feminist, who was against colonization in Algeria. She was a world traveler. She spoke five languages. She's just much smarter than me, obviously, and was just really cool. So it's wonderful to get to perform any new opera that sounds so gorgeous and is about somebody that I'm excited to learn about as well.
I'm excited to learn about it through the play, through the opera.
I'm Anne, and I'm the stage director, and I'm just thrilled to be working with both Marion and Gordon. We've worked together in other capacities or on other projects in the past. And so when Gordon offered me the opportunity to direct this opera, I just leapt at it because, as Marion has said, it's such an incredible story or character that we're exploring. The music is phenomenal, and the collaboration with these artists has been very satisfying and exciting so far.
Well, it sounds exciting. One of the questions that I ask people is, first of all, tell us a little bit more about your project. We're going to be airing a week before it starts. So tell us about where, when, and how people will be able to see it.
So this opera, it's a one-act opera. It's just over an hour long. It will play at the York Theatre, which is just off Commercial Drive in Vancouver. And it runs February 29th. At 7:30 p.m., March 2nd at 7:30 p.m., and March 3rd at 2 p.m. And there'll be a talk back after each performance to talk to Marion, to talk to me, to talk to Anne, ask the questions. And I think it'll be really cool for people to experience this unique offering.
I think it'll be a cool way for people to experience the start of Women's History Month.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting, I didn't know who Isabel Eberhardt was before I stumbled on this opera. And so to learn about this extraordinary woman, I now want everybody to know about her. So it is great that it happens at the beginning of Women's History Month. I think this is a woman who probably we should know more about, or more people should know about her, I should say.
Now, the significance of a one-act opera. How do you get so much history into one act?
Well, one thing that the opera does is instead of trying to cram her life into one act, as you say, that would be almost impossible because she lived so much, she probably has enough material for three or four operas. So instead of trying to sort of tell the story of Isabel's life in a chronological way, the composer and librettist are looking at one moment in her life, which is the moment she died in a flash flood in the middle of the desert or in Algeria. And so they're sort of looking at the moment from the time that you pass from life to death. And in that moment, there are all these fragments and memories and re-experiences of parts of her life that she sort of relives. So we're not being asked to sort of condense the entire history of her life in this short opera, but instead we see sort of, it's the subtitle of the opera is The Lives and Deaths of Isabel Eberhardt. So it's like we see this fragment of her as a lover, we see this fragment of her as a reveler, we see this fragment of her as an explorer. So it's sort of like little tastes of her life as she's making that final stage in her journey, which is passing from life to death.
Now, in writing and developing that, how did you get and gather the research? What are some of your sources?
Oh, it's actually a piece that's composed by a composer named Missy Mazzoli, who is an alive and well composer from New York, and a librettist who wrote all the words, or who put the words together, I should say, named Royce Vavrick, and he is Canadian. And so they teamed up to make the piece. And through their research, I don't know what their process was of researching, but they came across this amazing character and decided to write an opera. And actually, Isabel wrote her whole life. And she wrote all this beautiful poetry. She wrote a journal about her travels and her experiences, her adventures, her heartbreaks. And so it is, the whole thing is made up of her words, actually. They just arranged them in a way that tells the story.
Very unique storytelling. It also, when one of the most common ways people talk about death is at this flashback. So you're actually bringing to life flashback.
Yeah, that sort of was the way in for me to understand the opera, because it is these sort of fragments that are not necessarily connected in a chronological way. But once I realized that we could sort of look at the first scene and then the final concluding scene as to the two bookends, and then within those bookends, it is like that sort of classic idea of in the moment before you pass, the, you know, fragments of your life flash in front of you. So, and the way that we look at it too, because there's also a 5-person chorus in this opera too. So it's like they are parts of Isabel that are sort of guiding her through these different fragments of her life to help her take what she needs to take with her into the next stage of her existence. So she sort of needs to learn or remember or let go of something in each fragment before she can continue on.
Now, I think, you know, there's sometimes people who say, oh, I don't like opera, because they just have one picture in their mind of what it's like. Can you tell us a little bit of the things of the structure of an opera when you said that there are these beings that gather alone? Can you share with anyone who may not know what's the basic structure, and then what's the difference with contemporary?
Yeah, those are great, great questions. And actually, because I work in, well, we all work in opera a lot, this is a conversation that I think most of us are used to having, because people who maybe not necessarily have experienced opera have these notions of what it is. You know, you see snippets of opera in a movie, and it's a sort of a particular caricature of what opera can be. This is very different. This is a chamber opera, which means it's very small. So it's in a small theater. So we're not talking about, you know, 2,500 seats. Every seat, you sit close enough that you can actually see the facial expressions of the people on stage. Also, this opera is in English, and a lot of operas that we perform are in French or Italian or German, which adds an extra layer for some folks that make it a little less easy to get into. But this is in English, and it's really a very small, I would say an intimate creation of a big world, is how I would put it. There's so many big things that happen in it, but it's a very small space, and you have no choice but really to participate in it when you're sitting in the audience, which is a very different experience than if you go and see La Boheme, and there's, you know, or, you know, the classic example of Aida, where there's elephants and camels on the stage. It's not that. It's very different, and it's very accessible.
Right. I once had the experience of seeing Aida in Rome.
Wow.
With all the animals. You know.
Well, yeah. This is not that.
One of the classic things that is in this, though, is that the orchestra is in a pit below the stage, and the conductor is standing where he can see, Gordon here, is standing where he can see what's going on the stage and can cue everybody below and above, and kind of keep us all connected with each other. And on the stage, we have these scrims that present a place for media to be projected onto those scrims. which is being developed by some amazing media artists who live here in Toronto. Armina, where are we? Vancouver. I live in Toronto. I forget where I am sometimes. But that they, through that artwork that they've created, they have given us a track to create the worlds that Isabel is going through.
So really, the audience will be going on a journey.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And because Isabel was also an incredible poet, the words, because they're in English and they're like understandable, there's that experience of sort of processing the words as they're being said as well, and interpreting that as, you know, as she's traveling through the different vignettes as well. There's also a contemporary sound too in the orchestra. Maybe Gord, do you want to explain?
Yeah, it, right? Actually, yeah. This is a really different sound world that's been created by the composers and will be recreating when we get to the theater. You know, in traditional operas, it's usually a huge orchestra of can be 60, 80 players that's hidden underneath the stage, lots of brass instruments and string instruments. This is quite unique. There's only 5 players. So there's a flute player, a clarinet player, there's a pianist, there's a double bass player, and there's an electric guitar player, which is not something you normally expect to hear in an opera. Super cool. And then sort of on top or in around all of that, there's a pre-recorded electro sort of acoustic soundscape that has been created that we weave the instruments through and on and into and around. You know, one example that's really striking is one of the stories we tell about Isabel is her journey to North Africa on a boat. And so there are these recorded sounds of the ship and the waves, and we hear the birds and there's the ship's bell, and all of those things are integrated with the sort of what I would call normal instruments. So it creates a world that is unique from a sound perspective too.
It's very haunting and evocative too. And it really suits the what we've sort of described as her passing from life to death. Like after every vignette, we frequently go back to this sort of evocative, almost ghostly sound that then pushes her into her next memory. And it's really, I find it very powerful.
Yeah, and those who are big opera fans, so there's a divide of people who love new opera or contemporary music and people who are not there yet. So I would say that it's important to note that this music is very accessible. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's there are lots of melodies. I cannot stop humming them, walking down the street, in the shower, making breakfast. Like these beautiful melodies are running through my head all the time. And so people will leave the theater with something to hum. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that far into the spiky new music kind of range. And it borrows a tiny bit from jazz, I would say. That electric guitar reminds me a little bit of rock ballads. But all with this beautiful, very Missy Mazzoli musical language that is, it's almost like a spa for your ears.
Oh, a spa for your ears. I like that.
Dramatic. But it's also just lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny because I often refer to it like a warm bath of sound. Yeah. Like it's like a warm bath of sound at times. And then Marion has the most beautiful, warm voice that, I mean, I heard it live the other day for the first time. I guess because I've never heard you live before. Like we've worked together. We're always talking, but yeah, we have worked together, but I've never heard her sing in the same room before. And I felt myself get all teary eyed because it's just such a beautiful, warm, beautiful sound. So we're very lucky to be working with Marion.
Thank you, Anne.
I've had conversations with people about nature and also about how sound affects brain waves and how when you talked about you might find yourself humming it on the way home or in the shower, that's mm-hmm. one of the things that says how it's like medicine. It can be healing. Mm-hmm. So you can have this wonderful experience that days after you're still either harking back to from the visuals you've seen or from the music that you've heard.
Yeah, and I want to echo what Gord said earlier too, of like the difference between sitting in a, like the, you know, grand opera has its place, of course, we all love it, but being in that close to these incredible voices. So Marion, plus the five singers who were playing the chorus as well, all of them have astounding voices. And being that close, like there is something with the sound waves, I feel, that is an experience you can't get just by listening to the opera on a CD or CD is so old fashioned. Yeah. On a streaming service. Shows my age. but yeah, it's a very visceral experience, I find, that the audience would. For me, the most incredible operatic experiences as an audience has been in the smaller venues when I'm so close and I'm feeling like I can almost feel the sound waves hitting my chest. And like Gordon says, the being able to see into their eyes, and it's really quite something.
I also love the way music gives you an emotional language. So there's parts of your body that are hearing that story and taking it in that are probably not even conscious for us, but it just, we are like, if you watch a television show with absolutely no music, you are just watching people talk and it might not hit you the same way. But as soon as that music swells, it can make you emotional. And opera is like that. It's the whole thing is delivered with so much emotion.
It's like an early preview to spring. We don't have to wait until the end when they say it's the first day of spring. You can have that spring into your heart as you go to and listen to this opera.
I love that.
Absolutely.
Could each of you share a bit of, since there's such a long history and not many people are familiar, maybe one piece of something from her history that people would be interested in knowing?
So much. Yeah.
Wow, it's like, where to start? Yeah. I mean, I think what's, even though the opera is not a chronological story of her life at all, I think looking at where she came from and where she went, as a consequence of that is astounding. So she was born in Switzerland to a sort of unusual family setup. Her mother had escaped from her husband and ran away with the family tutor. And so there were unconventional aspects of her life from the beginning. But I think through her childhood and in her teens, I guess, several events really hit her hard, including the death of close family members, her brother, her father. And then that led, and that and other things led to her basically renouncing European society. She converted to Islam, and at the age of 20, she moved to Algeria, which I think is astounding for anyone at any time. But to think that this happened in, I don't know, 1910 or something like this, when women were even more restricted in terms of how they could come and go in society, I just think what a remarkable and brave person she must have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she also dressed in men's wear so that she could present as a man as much as she could. And I don't know if she was convincing, but fact that she was wearing those men's clothes just gave her access to places. She just took that space.
Yeah.
And that was so unusual for a woman at that time who would probably have had to have had an escort
with
her at all times. And that's something she learned from childhood. Her tutor actually encouraged her to go out into the streets of Geneva and see things on her own, but said, dress as a boy so that people will treat you with more respect.
Yeah.
And so she took that lesson with her right through her whole life.
She apparently, like, she wore the clothes of a man for, like, to be able to be free and travel as she wanted, also, though she was acknowledged as a woman. So it's like it was this very sort of interesting sort of existence that she had. She apparently took many lovers, but she married an Algerian soldier. And what else do we know about her? There's speculation that she was a sort of a precursor of anti-colonialism or decolonizing, she was not a fan of what was going on with the French colonization of Algeria, North Africa at that time, and spoke out and wrote about it a lot. But then there's also speculations that at times possibly she was doing work for the French. Like there's all sorts of just different sort of stories about her. her travel writing is phenomenal. I was saying to Marion the other day that like I began working through some of her work, and we're so used to reading travel blogs nowadays. But of course, everyone who's writing a travel blog now has access to email and internet, and they're quite safe wherever they go in the world because we have that sort of internet access. And she was all by herself writing these incredible accounts of the country that she was exploring and visiting, and very respectful. And I just find really intriguing accounts and a kind of writing that I think we don't see anymore. And also speaking about a world that is so long gone. So,
yeah, I would say she went to places not assuming that she was going to take charge there, but to learn about what that place was and to become a part of it in a more natural way, not assuming that her way was better.
Yes, as we're welcoming new people who might have just tuned in, we want you to know that today we are talking with Gordon Girard, the director, the soloist Marion Newman, and director Anne Hodges of the contemporary opera Song from the Uproar that is starting on, tell us again the date that it's
February 29th, March 2nd, and March 3rd.
And the location?
At the York Theater.
And where could people go? Is there a website for people?
Yeah. The best thing to do is to visit our website, which is cityoperavancouver.com. And there's more information there about the show and how to get tickets and showtimes and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. This show that you are listening to is the Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon, Saluwa show. I'm Charlotte Farrell, host of the show, and welcoming you to hearing about something that's going to be a fantastic way to start your Women's History Month. Would you, Marion, share again the name of this fantastic woman that the opera is about?
Isabel Eberhardt, an explorer, a lover,
a writer,
a beautiful poet, a reveler, as Anne said earlier. She really loved to party, and just a feeler of the biggest feelings.
And which, you know, is an answer to some people are told, oh, you're doing too much, or you have to stick with just one vein. And obviously she had both spiritual, political, artistic, so many veins that she spared.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's a quote, and I'm going to misquote it because I don't have it right in front of me, but I remember her saying, when I enter into new lands, I feel like I'm entering my life. Mm-hmm. Or when I enter into unknown lands, it might be that I feel like I'm entering my life. So she just had an adventure and a curiosity about everything, whether that's geographic or internal searches or what she's, you know, who she's meeting and everything. She was just always interested in what is new because that is what is filling her life.
I wonder, there's a series that I've done or doing where I ask artists, authors, et cetera, about three P's and two C's. The first is asking each of you, what do you see as your purpose in life?
Oh, that's
whoa.
A good one.
Who would like to
speak? I feel like, I've been working as a musician in some way professionally for, I don't know, 25 years or so now. First as a piano player and now more as a conductor. One of the things that keeps me going is seeing what music in its different forms does for people. Interacting with the audiences to see how these things affect them, the things that jump out for them that maybe necessarily didn't jump out for me, the conversations that this music starts, which eventually lead to, you know, our communities and our neighborhoods being better because of the conversations that happen inspired by music. That's my purpose. If I can encourage people to connect with people around them through music, then I'll feel like I've done something good and important.
Very important at a time when people are bashing each other with harsh, mean words and sounds.
Absolutely.
I think it's a huge question. But what's coming to mind first is that I am Indigenous. I'm First Nations from BC. I'm Quagyilth and Stalo on my dad's side. And I'm also settler in my mother, English, Irish, Scottish. I have that heritage. And I say heritage because I've never lived in any of those places. I've visited some, but I haven't actually lived there. So although some of that culture came with my grandparents and I've learned some of that. Anyway, my dad went to residential school, as did all my aunts and uncles and my grandparents. And that really cut us off from culture and opportunities and a place, like a voice in society. And I am this incredibly privileged being that was born into a family who gave me everything, every opportunity to learn, every opportunity to avoid racism for as long as possible until I was strong enough to be able to face it. And I have this voice. I keep being given opportunities to share experience, to try new things out. And so I think it is my job to say yes to those opportunities, and in doing so, to gather younger people and other people who are learning new things around me, who are like me, to say, you have space too. So to kind of pave that way for more voices to join in that have a similar experience to mine. And so I have a list I keep collecting of a circle of Indigenous musical artists or theatrical artists, and finding ways for us to connect and tell our stories, and the stories that we want to tell about ourselves, so that it's not this romantic notion that keeps being placed on who we are. So I guess that's actually a couple of things, but just how being our authentic selves in a public way, and creating partnerships with people so that we have safe spaces to be who we really are.
Thank you, Marianne.
Awesome answers from my colleagues here. It is such a huge question. And I think as soon as you said it, I thought, okay, I'm going to come back at it with a different P, which is like, I feel like my purpose is to fulfill my potential. And I think that in the last decade or so, I've sort of recognized that sometimes that potential is artistic, you know, different types of artistic projects that I may have skills in or be able to help make happen. And sometimes it's just within my family or as a friend or something like that. So it's sort of trying to, you know, recognize that it is okay to pause on one part of things if they're fulfilling a potential in another part of your life. So I think that's what I've been learning in the last few years, particularly since the pandemic, I would say.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. Each of you have mentioned something that's an element of sharing or training or bringing others along. That connects kind of with the mission of CGASF. It's a college radio station. And rather than bringing, we can bring top 40 music, but being a door through which people can play, send their songs to be listened to by a group that decides it's going on the air, or being able to highlight when there's shows or programs. And also Simon Fraser as a university is a source of communicative, of critical thinking, as well as contemplative thinking. I think that your purposes align with that. And it's a good thing, because when we talk about the 92 Acts of Reconciliation, they have a specific of saying we're making space, we're saving space, and not just for this group of people, but to make it something that's a part of the heritage of Canada and part of the heritage of wherever a person finds themselves right now. And acknowledge that our work takes place on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Something that someone asked in another interview is like, okay, so when we're getting it back, what do you the creative arts and land acknowledgements of the importance. Do you, when you are playing or talking, acknowledge some of the music or stories that have come from that particular land or territory?
I am very aware of land acknowledgements. I come from culture where we were giving them long before they became a thing to wider society. And it's always been as a way of saying, thank you for having me. I'm really grateful to be here at this ceremony or this feast, this gathering. Here's who I am. Here's how I put myself into context. I'm from this place. And so if you need a witness to anything, you'll know where to find me. And also thank you for hosting me here and acknowledging who it was that made the invite and where you're staying. And being given the space to speak. And so that really is what land acknowledgements are for me traditionally. And it is really interesting to watch as organizations across this nation make land acknowledgements and figure out, you know, what they are, what they mean. Should they be recorded? Should they be spoken? Should they involve an in-the-moment thing? And I think all of it, yes, whatever that journey is to remind you of the privilege of those who came here and took land away, started dividing land up instead of sharing and making treaties with each other, because, you know, this might be a better fishing ground and that might be a better hunting ground and this might be a great place to grow food. There were partnerships made with indigenous tribes right across this nation, anywhere you could get to by water, basically. People were visiting each other and having to work out how you share that space. And another that you referenced land back. And for me, I've learned this actually from my brother, who's I have a sibling council, my two siblings, that we talk a lot and we bounce ideas off each other. And it was my brother who came up with the articulating that land back to us means that we give our respect back to the land. Instead of looking at the land as what can we get from it all the time, what can we give it? And how can we live our lives so that we acknowledge that we are actually part of the earth? We're not these aliens that were flown in to take whatever we want. We're actually part of the earth. And so just reversing our thinking, I think whatever it means, whether you're giving parcels of land back to different people or whatever, if you give your respect back to the land and it's being treated well, it's more likely that we'll all be able to live here in harmony and we'll all have enough.
I love that.
Thank you for that explanation. Yeah, explanation. It's an encouragement, because sometimes people argue about the land acknowledgement when you're saying it's thinking about what we can give back to the land. Of course, when people are putting multi-million dollar structures on something, they're not talking about giving back this corner of Vancouver that's got all these structures. That idea of giving back something of yourself and something that helps forward our communications and the way we treat each other, that was wonderful. Thank you.
And I like to, you know, I'm going to acknowledge I want a roof over my head and a floor under my feet. Like, I'm not that we have to go back to nature and live like the hippies of the 80s would have told us to, but that we acknowledge what we are as humans, what we are doing, and do it in balance.
One of the third P around what are you passionate about? Are you involved in mentoring, or do you have students that ask to get involved in things like the opera that you are producing now or working on?
Yeah, one of the I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the great aspects of this show is that our five chorus members, the solo voices that make up this terrific chorus, they're all students. They're from the UBC opera program, and they're all, I think it's been demonstrated to us that they have great potential to go on and have amazing careers of their own. But they're just starting out, you know, they're still in school. In fact, they're running from rehearsals at school to rehearsals here and back. They're working probably harder than any of us. And we just love them. They're fantastic. And so to have that kind of energy come into the room and to whatever bits that we've picked up along our path, because we've been doing it longer, passing it on to them, I think is it's very important to us. I think all of us probably can think about the people in our lives when we were young that passed things on. So it feels like a great privilege and a responsibility, I guess, to also give a little bit to the folks who are coming in after us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm pretty passionate about passing on, you know, what I can, just because I'm passionate about directing and about opera and about theater and everything. So I also teach directing with a college in Ontario and really enjoy doing that. And coincidentally, at one time, Gord was a student of mine.
It's true. Symbols.
I was very young. Yeah. And just to go back to the UBC students, like when I heard their voices on the first day, I was blown away. Like, I didn't really know what we would face with, you know, five students, but they are phenomenal musicians and really we're sort of seeing the next gen of opera in Canada with those five young people. Their voices, I can see them already making big strides or big marks on Canadian opera.
Yeah, and they're so quick. I'm reminded of like how much better my memory was all those years ago. And also they're so enthusiastic and so caring as colleagues. They're really helping me to remember where I'm supposed to be. And they just give me that youthful energy. It makes me feel less old. And it's really fun to work with them, honestly. They're They're wonderful colleagues. And I would say not just to focus on the students, but that this cast, and I mean the people behind the scenes, the designers, the lighting, the stage management, directorship, and performers, and the instrumentalists when they arrive. We have a pianist that we work with until the week of, and so that pianist is in the room as well. We're all at different stages. We're all at different ages. And that's what makes up a community. If we were all the same, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have our different life stages to offer to each other. And it's so important for me as someone who's like on the older end, but a little bit feeling in the middle, that to have in both directions in that circle, like lessons from what people are going through in their stages of life.
Yeah, I'm happy that you've expressed your passion and your interest in availability to students, because the typical movies or context that's given is that it's just snobbish people. They don't want to be bothered with students. They cut off access. But would you say, is there a time after the show has finished that you're in the lobby or in areas where someone wanted to come and say hello to you? Are you accessible after the show?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think I mentioned before, we're actually going to have a sort of talk back session after each show. So people in the audience are we hope actually will stick around and chat with us, ask questions, give us thoughts on what they saw and what they experienced. But certainly also it doesn't need to even be that formal if it's, you know, just a moment in the lobby. I do really, really love those moments of, you know, what did you think of this? Even if you didn't like it, tell me. I want to know what this was for you. And I always love coming across people who aren't too shy to do that, because I think also they see, oh, well, this person's, you know, important or whatever, and I shouldn't say. But I always want to hear, what do you think of all that?
Me too. I love meeting people who have been in the audience. I love being in the audience. So making that connection is a very important part of this work.
Yeah. And as a director, like, we are always the only director in the room, and Gord would always be the only conductor in the room. So if anyone ever approaches me and says, Anne, I'd love to learn about directing, I'm usually all over that. Like, let's figure out how we can either get you in a rehearsal hall if it's not mine, it's someone else's, or have a coffee and just talk about the steps you can take, because it's not like you can sit at, well, there are classes for directing. I teach one, but but when you're actually doing it, you know, it's nice to be able to welcome young people into the rehearsal hall. So yeah, I love it when people reach out. Sometimes it's through Facebook or Instagram, or you know, they dig up my email somehow, or in a lobby. And it has happened where people come up to me in a lobby and say, you know, I just want to have a coffee with you at some point, and or can I send you my resume or something, and then we have a chat, and sure enough, 2 or 3 years later, we're working together. And it's pretty awesome how that happens with the little web of connections that we can make through these chance occasions.
And just in the few weeks that this production takes place, Gordon, as the director of the company, has opened the doors to certain people to come in and watch a rehearsal. And that is good for us, both in that we are able to converse with them right there and then. We had a kid there the other day who was just all agog. And it's so nice to see that curiosity. It helps to push us over, to push us to perform better and with more integrity, I think. And it's just interesting. It's part of the community to have them in there while we're still growing the piece, as it were.
And I'm not sure if, but Vlad, our design sort of head of design for this project, has brought on, he's at SMU, and he's brought on Kata Yoon and Alex, lighting designer and projection sort of designer, who, when I had my first meeting with Kata Yoon and Alex, they were like, how are you doing? And I realized that they had been students together before, but now they're both working professionally. And so it is that kind of passing on of knowledge and building of, you know, and people entering their careers and beginning to work and then work with each other again, too. So, yeah, we've got good representation from SFU.
Mm-hmm. We have confirmation that directors, lead vocalists, researchers do welcome students, and there is a way to contact. Now, with the C, you know, I said we had three P's, but two C's. One of them you started to talk about, which is contact. Do you have a way that you could share, that each of you could share, of how people would contact you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's either people can go to the cityofforvancouver.com website and you can send me an email through that, or people are very welcome to visit my own site, which is just my full name, gordongerard.com, and people can send emails that way as well.
Do you mind spelling that, Gordon?
I'm sorry?
Mind spelling that?
Yeah, so it's GordonGerard.com.
Okay, thank you. Marian?
Yeah, I have a website. It's mariannewman.com, and that's MarionNewman. And that's for performance stuff. There is an address there to reach out to me. And I'm also on social media, which I actually made my address for social media before I knew that it was going to be for more than just my family. So it's a childhood nickname, but it is Miss Prill, MissPrill at Facebook, at Instagram, and those are the two that I use the most.
I don't have a website. I actually have a website, but I have not launched it.
I've been there for a long time.
But Facebook, I mean, there's lots of Ann Hodges out there in the world, but I'm the one that looks like my little photo that would be in the program or on the website. But through Gord, people could reach me. I also have an agency. Like, I'm with Talent House and Dean Artists, which is another way if people, those are the sort of theater and opera agents that I deal with. So if people needed to reach me, that is a way that they could reach me as well.
Could you mention those two again, please?
Sure. Talent House. So, and I think it's talenthouse.ca. And then Dean Artists is sort of the sister agency that deals with opera. I think it's just deanartists.ca, but don't quote me on that. But you could Google Dean Artists, and then my agent would pop up, or my little portfolio would pop up too.
Okay, now the other C was causes. You talked about in the flashback how how many causes and events Mrs. Eberhardt was involved in. What is causes? Is there any particular cause that each of you are involved in?
That's a good question. I spend most of my waking hours trying to keep, actually, I am the artistic head of two different organizations. One is City Opera Vancouver, which we've been talking about today. The other one is the Regina Symphony Orchestra. So I spend most of my waking hours trying to keep those two organizations afloat, which is in this sort of post-pandemic period or whatever we are, is a challenge. So I think my causes are all tied in with keeping music alive in this country.
Yeah, and actually during the pandemic, when performance opportunities went quiet for quite a while, I answered the call that a lot of companies had already been making to talk about equity, diversity, and inclusion with the whole musical community. And part of that was through the Canadian Music Centre as a body of music that Canadian composers have created that contains appropriated Indigenous song in it. And so one of them has been to figure out what to do with that with that music, how to categorize what is appropriation and what permissions there were in place, how those pieces can be performed. And of course, all of this occurred when the needle wasn't where it is now. I'm not trying to throw shade on people who did that because they thought they were doing the right thing. And they thought that Indigenous song was all just folk songs. And so it wouldn't necessarily have meaning, but it is emerging that there are reasons for songs. There are times for songs to be sung, and there are songs that should only be sung by family members, etc. So helping share what those rules are, they change from nation to nation. And so I can only represent my own, but I've been learning that and helping to guide along with a whole team of colleagues, what to do with that body of music and how to bring some of it to the light that hasn't been performed that could be, and how to do that in the appropriate ways.
Yeah, I would say like formally the causes that I'm sort of participate in. I'm on a board for the Manitoba Association of Playwrights. I'm the chair of the board there, which is a service organization that supports new playwriting, and that includes musicals. So far, I don't think it includes opera, but it, you know, theater as writers. So I'm on the board for that. And I would say a lot of my sort of causes happen through my teaching. Like me, I have a co-teacher, two co-teachers, where we're teaching artistic leaders. I teach directing and they teach music directing and choreography. And we really sort of share this belief that we can, through the young people, change how theater is created. And I include opera in that. And, you know, the way that we run a rehearsal room, principles of equity and inclusion, et cetera. So I feel like that's where I get very passionate through building the curriculum and passing it on in my courses there. And then just, you know, like I sort of hinted at earlier, sometimes I used to do pet therapy with my dog. I have a little dog and we would visit a seniors center and do that once a week, but he's old now and it kind of stopped during the pandemic. But I feel like one of my major causes right now is just my aging family members. My parents are, you know, they take a lot of time, but it's a cause that I really am invested in because I love them and I want to spend these final years with them as much as I can. So. Mm-hmm.
So now you've heard it here on CJSF, the Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon show, that yes, it is here are three people who are very busy, very involved in their creativity, that still have time to get involved with causes. And anyone that tells you, oh, if you're building your career, stay away from causes, here is just an example of no, there are rich opportunities. And it is so important for music to be spread and to people to find out and feel you don't have to be stuck with just one genre, that it's important to learn about different cultures and learn about different styles. And now this different style of opera, this contemporary opera. So I want to thank you all for sharing your information and your enthusiasm with me this morning and look forward to going to the play. I mean, not to the play.
We do it all the time.
That's it. Thank you so much for your warm welcome and your terrific questions.
Yes.
This has been really lovely.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been nice to meet you.
Thank you.
We're going to be checking with you about some music. We can, little bits that we can play throughout this as we have a few station breaks within the program.
Perfect. Okay.
Awesome. You want to recommend, you could put it in the chat. Our chat is working, right? You can put it in the chat.
Okay. We can send you, there's a recording of the opera that's available on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. So we can probably just choose a couple of little things that would be a nice taste for people to hear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That would be wonderful.
Great.
Cool. So this is Friday at 10. I want to welcome you to come again next week. I'm Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here at the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby on the Mountain and streaming worldwide at cjsf.ca. I said I'll see you next week at 10, but when people ask me what time it is, I say it's always love time poems.
Love time. Yes.
Poem time.
Well, for that.
Love time. Poem time. Love time. Poem time. Time for words from heaven to shine. Love time. Poem time. Time for words to pattern and rhyme. Love time. Poem time. Time for words to wash the wounds, bind the lashes, and play bassoon. Love time, poem time. Time for poems, poets, and singers. Time to untie all life's ringers. Poem time, love time. Time for you to reveal to me. Unravel all your mystery. Time for joy and utter grace. Rest from toiling in this place. Place of poems, place of words. Place for love instead of swords. Love time, poem time. Poem time, love time. Love time, poem time, times for words from heaven to shine. Love time, poem time, time for words to pattern and rhyme. Love time, poem time, times for words to wash the wounds, bind the lashes and play bassoon. Love time, poem time, poem time, love time. Time for poems, poets, singers, time to untie all life's ringers. Time for you to reveal to me, unravel all your mystery. Time for joy and utter grace, rest from toiling in this place. Place of poems, place of words, place for love instead of swords. Love time, poem time, poem time, love time. Love time, poem time, poem time, love time, love time.